Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
A third of students are less than happy about their university choice, new research by EY has revealed. The findings suggest that a digital rethink is essential to meet the expectations of students and staff. Universities can address this by putting the needs of the people they serve at the heart of their digital strategies. Learn more about the future of human-centered higher education at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.
This is The Guardian.
If we get better at listening to one another, our society gets stronger. And that's really what I'm determined to do over the next few weeks, to engage in a deep listening project, to try and bring people together, to recognise that different perspectives don't necessarily and shouldn't mean conflict here, but we can build bridges to understanding.
Hello, lovely people of Pods. Welcome to the show. You're with Catherine Murphy. I'm political editor of Guardian Australia. With me on the program this week is the Minister for Immigration and Multicultural Affairs, Andrew Giles. These are anxious times. The ASIO boss, Mike Burgess, has made a rare public intervention, urging Australians to keep their words measured and warning about the potential for opportunistic violence in our country. This is in the wake of the escalating conflict in the Middle East. It seemed to me to be the right time to have a think about social cohesion. That's why Andrew's on the show. Listen up. Andrew Giles, welcome to the pod.
Great to be with you, Catherine.
I think many listeners will feel quite overwhelmed at the moment. We've emerged after a bruising referendum debate, a polarising campaign spanning many, many months. The conflict in Israel is deeply unsettling for diaspora communities here and for the rest of us, quite frankly. How concerned are you about social cohesion in Australia right at the moment?
I'm very concerned, and I don't want to alarm in any way that goes beyond the frame of this, but I think we recognise that the events of the 7th of October, that abhorrent terrorist attack by Hamas, shocked Australians and shocked people around the world. And the images we see every day, every morning when we wake up on our television screens, we seek to imagine the just the sheer volume of innocent life, Palestinian and Israeli, that's lost. You know, for anyone who doesn't feel a direct personal connection, it is overwhelming and awful. But we've got to appreciate that there are hundreds of thousands of Australians who have a direct, immediate personal connection to this awful conflict. So for me, as the Minister for Multicultural Affairs, you know, my focus, my absolute priority is on ensuring that we do everything that we can to keep Australians together, to make sure that we never take for granted our hard-won social cohesion and support for a multicultural and diverse society. That's challenging, but it needs to be an absolute focus.
And we'll come back to Israel and Palestine. Let's just start with the referendum and what might be needed in the wake of that no result. Now, obviously, a large number of Indigenous leaders have been silent since Saturday night. There's obviously a recalibration and a grieving occurring after that election defeat. But, you know, there are obviously implications now with people like Marcia Langton out and about saying reconciliation is dead. How we sort of bring the country back together, not only Indigenous Australians and the rest, but also yes voters and no voters. So I'm keen to hear your ideas about that and also keen to hear how the government's anti-racism strategy may fit into the sort of, dare we say, an act of leadership to bring the country back together after this result.
Yeah, I mean, that's an enormous question, and I'll only sketch at a response to it for a couple of reasons. One, I strongly believe that we do need to allow Indigenous leaders the time that the majority of them have asked for to reflect. And I think we've also got to all take the time to digest what the process that we've been through means. Now, of course, like every Australian, every member of the government, I accept the verdict the Australian people delivered on Saturday, disappointed, deeply disappointed as I am through it. But I took great heart from the contributions that night of the Prime Minister and Minister Burney, and I do recognise the way in which that they have sought to frame the conversation going forward. I don't think the decision on Saturday is a rejection of reconciliation. I don't think it means that Australians aren't deeply concerned about some of the challenges that we face in trying to close the gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. We do have to think about how we go about that, and we have to keep listening. So I will pause my remarks at that point because I want to listen. I think we need to listen, all of us. But the second part of your question is fundamentally important because it goes to the steps that we can and should do to ensure that every Australian feels that they belong, that they are respected and they are valued. And I think those are propositions that are almost universally shared. And a foundation stone for that is a rejection of racism and a recognition of the damage it does. The damage it does, obviously, to individuals who are excluded, abused, denied opportunities. But I think the damage it does to our sense of society, our sense of an identity as Australians. That's why, in opposition, we committed to a new national anti-racism strategy. And I think right now, for all the reasons we've been talking about already, it's more important than ever to have a society that's anchored in a sense that we all deserve to be valued and no one deserves to be treated differently because of their ethnic origin, their indigeneity, or any other attribute they have. We've got to do better at recognising that racism, anti-Semitism and Islamophobia have all been on the increase for some time and that there are forces in our society who seek to exploit those things. So building a strategy that's all about bringing Australians together and recognising the harms that racism does, again, not just to individuals but to our sense of society, is absolutely fundamental right now.
And for listeners, and there may be some who are just completely unaware about the anti-racism strategy, have not heard about it before, give them a sense of, sort of broadly what you're working on and the timeframes for delivering it.
Yeah, so we've been working with the Australian Human Rights Commission for some time now to build on the very successful Racism It Stops With Me campaign of some time ago, to build an understanding both of how racism impacts Australians and how we can do more to recognise and prevent racist behaviours at every level of the spectrum, from the unconsidered and casual to more obvious and overt forms of abuse. Some research has gone into how we best go about it and how we best engage Australians who, in the context of busy lives, may not have the bandwidth to think through some of these issues in detail and find effective ways of connecting them to experiences that may not be part of their lives. So that's the focus right now. But I think there's a renewed sense of urgency given the events of recent weeks.
And it's that point you made just before we got to urgency, that point you made about reaching people. Like that's sort of at the foundation of everything, really, because I think if there's a sort of single lesson from the referendum, it's that, in the sense that campaigners, reported that people were just completely head down in material concerns about life for completely understandable reasons. I think we're all a bit like that, really. But the people proved quite difficult to reach, particularly in an environment where there's conflict or a perception of conflict. So I wonder if I could tease you out a fraction more on how do we reach people.
For those of us, anyone in political life, we obviously want to make change. And for those of us on the broad left or centre left, we want to instill progressive change. And for me, that means being really clear about seeing people where they are, imagining where we'd like to be as a society and building a bridge between those two things without assuming too much. And I think that assumption about the space that people might have for the issues that matter to me is something that's difficult sometimes to overcome.
Mm.
And I think that is a big lesson of recent politics around the world, that we've got to understand how all the pressures and dimensions of an individual's life impact on their willingness or capacity to engage in issues that might matter to me.
Mm.
And again, we've got to be where people are, not where we want them to be.
And by urgency, let's just try and pin that a bit too. By urgency, what do you mean? You mean you will bring it forward, or what do you mean?
Well, definitely. I mean, one of the things that I'm really concerned to do in terms of responding to the impact of the Hamas-Israel conflict is to make sure that I'm engaged in a process of engagement with affected community members, Palestinian, the wider Muslim community, the wider Middle Eastern community, of course, the Jewish Australian community. Engagement that I would say is consequential. So I'm not just having meetings, but I'm taking on board the sentiments and ideas that exist there. And I want to make sure that the actions that government either facilitates or does is deeply grounded in what we are hearing from people who are directly affected.
Well, that point about meeting people where they are.
That's exactly it, Catherine.
So you don't want to give me a time frame for when this accelerated anti-racism strategy may join us?
Well, I think, you know, we listened to the advice of Mike Burgess, our security agencies. We look at the fact that there have been at least two neo-Nazi incidents on the streets of Melbourne in recent times. That lends a sense of urgency. So I think we've got to combine the fact that there are heightened reasons to advance an anti-racism agenda, but we've also got to make sure, for the reasons that we were just talking about, that the strategy speaks to those it needs to speak to.
Yeah.
It isn't just something that's a great document on paper, that we know it can be effectively communicated across the community. That's a really big part of this challenge. And I think that's the broader reflection I would make here as we work our way through what's going to be, you know, an ongoing difficult debate. All of us who occupy the privileged spaces in public life, or indeed the media, need to think really carefully about how we speak and focus on words that bring people together rather than foster division.
And you mentioned Mike Burgess a minute ago, the head of ASIO, who has sort of issued some rare public guidance about the way debates are conducted, but also warned that there is there is the scope or the window for opportunistic violence, I think was his turn of phrase. I mean, we started with the question, how worried are you? You said very. That sounds worrying.
Well, I think the two neo-Nazi incidents are things that can't be ignored. And we need to think about the effect of the individuals directly the subject of that, but also on the chilling effect. And again, I want to live in a society where everyone belongs, where everyone is valued, and where public space is open to everyone. I guess that's one of the harms of racism, that it denies those rights to people. So I think we need to be really careful as we move our way through the coming days to make sure that we are speaking thoughtfully, that we're not rushing to judgment, and we are enabling people to get that sense that we are a nation that is united, a nation that values our diversity, in which everyone is respected, where everyone's voices are heard, and where everyone can fully participate in our life.
I want to just sort of step back slightly, still on the same theme, because I think the discussion about social cohesion was the only discussion that listeners needed from us, really, this after the last week. But I would just, obviously, there's a context sitting behind sort of recent events, and always with when I consider these issues, my go-to sort of data points are the work the Scanlon Foundation has done since 2007 to track a sense of, you know, social cohesion in Australia. The last survey last year, I don't think we've seen the new one yet, the last survey was basically said social cohesion's at a tipping point. It said basically it's at a tipping point because we are now post-pandemic. The economic supports that were kind of rolled out during the pandemic have been withdrawn. Cost of living pressure is back. And basically people who are under financial stress are much less likely to see multiculturalism as a valuable plus for the country. So there's that. There's, you know, people in financial distress. Then there's also young people. You know, that Scanlon research and the more recent recut of the data with some other economic indicators led them to quite a sort of mind-focusing conclusion that young people in Australia are just not buying into the national identity or national project of this country. So they seem pretty big challenges for a government. How are you thinking through those things?
Well, they are big challenges, but I think there's something in the Scanlon survey that I think is a really significant counterweight to some of the propositions you put forward, and that is that 9 in 10 Australians value multiculturalism.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, the large majority, also very large majority, are deeply appreciative of what immigration has brought to us in its cultural as well as its economic dimension. So I'd say that, you know, it's not all doom and gloom.
No, that's fair.
If you look around the world, what Scanlon tells you is that we have built the world's most successful multicultural society.
Mm.
What it also tells you is that we cannot take it for granted.
Mm.
I certainly don't as minister, and I'm really concerned about, you know, some of the undercurrents that you've referred to. You know, we spoke a minute ago or a few minutes ago about how people, when they're under strained economic circumstances, obviously are focused resolutely on the day-to-day.
Yep.
We've got to recognise that. Of course they are. And, of course, our priority as a government is supporting them to get through the day-to-day.
Yeah.
But in doing that, we're not forgetting about the things that make a society, our Australian values, our shared multicultural values. So, you know, it's about doing both of those things and recognising that they should be complementary.
Yeah.
If we speak to people on their terms and we create the space for engagement, and that's particularly true, I think, about younger people with all the generational dimensions that are becoming an increasing feature of our economic as well as our political debate. And for some of the reasons you touched upon, we committed at the election to a review of our multicultural framework, something that hasn't happened 50 years since really we embraced multiculturalism under Whitlam and Grasby. And I've been really interested in this because I think it's a reflection of who we are as a country, but also because I've seen so many distinctions based not on someone's cultural, religious, ethnic or national background, but on their age.
Mm.
And that has been a really big feature to me. And as we've structured the review, a big focus on the part of the reviewers has been to facilitate contributions, not simply in the traditional large Word doc, heavily footnoted style, but to enable not just contributions in a wide variety of the languages commonly spoken in our country, but in different formats, like in video or audio, reflecting how a lot of people a little bit younger than you and me prefer to communicate. Because I do feel that a lot of younger people don't have that sense of buy-in. They don't have that sense of purchase in our society, probably because they don't feel the sense of purchase in our economy.
So picking up from that point, Andrew, age is becoming a factor because of sort of that intergenerational equity issue. And that's really fascinating, and it sort of ricochets all through politics in so many different ways. We also have to sort of look at the migration piece, I think, if we're talking about multiculturalism. There's very high levels of migration in Australia at the moment because obviously post-pandemic students returned. There are a lot of people here at the moment. And the government's objective in a policy sense is to find more permanent pathways to residency and citizenship and all that sort of stuff rather than having these big, big temporary movements of people. Basically, you know, sort of putting this piece together, and I know you're encouraging me not to be a doomsayer, and I'm sorry because this is a bit of a downer, guys, listening this weekend. I am sorry. I'm perhaps not quite as depressed about the world as I seem this weekend, but I am a little bit depressed about the state of the world, and I don't imagine I'm alone. But anyway, so we've sort of got a piece at the moment of polarisation, conflict ricocheting through diaspora communities. We've got a schism we need to repair between the original inhabitants of the continent and everybody else. We've got rising sort of economic pressure. We've got a lot of migrants in the country at the moment and people worried about housing and all of this sort of stuff. Again, this is a really complex set of dynamics for a migration and multiculturalism minister to manage. How do you propose to manage them?
Well, that's not the easiest question I've been asked. And I think, you know, I'll look forward to question time today on that basis, Catherine. But look, what I'd say is this. When it comes to managing the migration program, there's a couple of things that we are focused on. The big one, as you touched upon, is getting the balance right as in terms of how Australians have consistently thought of our migration program, that it is a path to permanency, and that really is a more managed approach through the permanent intake that we set every year in the budget. What we have seen over a long period of time, starting really under Howard, is an increasing proportion of people becoming what we would say is permanently temporary.
Yeah.
And that has a couple of consequences. One is obviously we're talking about demand-driven aspects of the program,
mm-hmm.
Running perhaps out of balance with the permanent intake. But also that sense of not being particularly anchored in Australia has some consequences for them.
Yeah.
So it's trying to get the balance right, because we recognise, firstly, that it's a good thing that people want to come to Australia. We recognise that also there are some skill shortages that we need to fill in the short term from overseas. But what we need to do after a wasted decade is to line that up with our domestic training. And the work that Brendan O'Connor has done in founding Jobs and Skills Australia must be seen as an essential counterpoint to our skilled migration system. And that's going to be, over time, a huge part of the puzzle that deals with some of the challenges that you refer to, making sure that we've got these two streams running together, not in opposite directions, which has been the case for the last decade.
Yeah, and it's sort of interesting because obviously you referred a minute ago to a review of multiculturalism, the first since the year dot. You've also got a review of migration, which is sort of imminent, is it?
Yeah. I mean, the work that Martin Parkinson and Joanna Howe and John Azaris did and was delivered to government, which has been sort of widely talked about in the public, our migration strategy that's being led by Minister Claire O'Neill is pretty close to being released.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the sort of long-term structured response that has been missing, because what Australians saw over the last decade, in particular under Peter Dutton, was a gap between a deep fondness for rhetoric about managing migration that was completely inconsistent with attention to the immigration function of national government, which was neglected at a policy level, but more fundamentally, and I don't think this is as recognised as it should be, neglected at a level of basic administration. So we are trying to not just unravel a policy debate that's underdone, but an administrative and indeed an enforcement and integrity focus, as Christine Nixon's shocking report has shown, that has left our migration system not in a state that's fit for our purposes.
But in terms of the review, if you guys have missed the Nixon review, this has been handed down in the last couple of weeks and basically just demonstrated that the management of the pipeline is just all over the shop, and people are being exploited anyway, go and have a look online if you haven't seen that. I'm interested about the review in terms of, because we're having a very conceptual conversation today, which I think is actually really valuable to people. What are we likely? I'm not saying give me the document, Andrew. I'm just saying what are we likely to see in this response? It's sort of because you're saying, you know, we need to kind of go back to and establish, you know, what multiculturalism is in Australia and why it matters. We've got to look at the migration system to make sure that it's, you know, that it's working effectively and that it's serving national objectives. You know, are we likely to see, I don't know, targets of particular number of migration streams? Like, or what is this thing? Is it sort of like, I think people would be quite interested.
I'm going to disappoint you, and so I'm not going to preempt what the review, what the strategy is going to say, but I think it's worth talking through some of the principles that we are keen on having our migration system exemplify, and that fundamentally is a migration system that is tethered squarely in the national interest. And that for us means a refocus back to pathways to permanency in place of effectively the
permanent temporary.
Yeah, the permanent temporary, a demand-driven system that is not serving the national interest. It means recognising, for me, that the immigration system should best be conceived of as something that's facilitative rather than determinative of wider policy outcomes. And again, over time, we haven't seen, and this is the most obvious area, the migration system and the education system working closely together. Because if you look at international students, that's a really big part of our intake and a big part of the demand-driven intake.
Yep.
It's an incredibly important industry for Australia, but it's also been the site of many of the challenges that we are seeing in the program. So we do need to make sure that both our migration settings and our higher education and vet settings maintain integrity. But that has to be a collective process, and I'm really pleased to work with Minister O'Neill, with Minister O'Connor and Minister Clare on recognising that these systems need to work together. That's a really important part of this puzzle, which frankly was forgotten about for the near decade of Conservative administration.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, it's galling really, that all that focus on the false binaries of, you know, stop the boats and all of that sort of stuff. And meanwhile, it's, anyway. Let's move on. I want to just engage you briefly because I'm aware you went to the UK very recently and you had some meetings in London, and you also went to the British Labour Conference. Looking at a distance, the British migration or immigration debate now looks about as balked as ours. So I'm interested in your reflections on sort of, you know, the dynamics over there, and also as an attendee of the Labour Conference, I think a lot of listeners will be curious, you know, is Labour on a path to winning an election or what's going on there?
Yeah. One of the great advantages of being in the UK was to get a sense of the Australian debate from outside. And a really important element that is often overlooked, I think, probably including by me from time to time, is that debates around migration don't exist solely in a national context, obviously, because they involve the choices that prospective migrants are making. And for me, it was absolutely striking to see the similarities of the debate taking place in the UK. And I think we can probably say across all of the English-speaking advanced economies. So,
do you mean by that, sorry to cut you off, do you mean in terms of the rhetoric or do you mean in terms of the substance or both?
Well, both, but I was really thinking about the substance.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for example, we were anxious in Australia to see what was going to happen with the return of international students post the pandemic. We've seen enormous demand. That isn't simply an Australian phenomenon. It's something that people in the UK are grappling with. It's something that is also impacting Canada, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that sense of, I guess, shared circumstances, shared policy challenges, I think is important to perceive. And that goes to the related point that I think it's really important to recognise that our migration settings are really important, but for many they are not important in and of themselves. People look at how other countries' migration settings operate as well.
Yeah.
So getting a clear sense of what's going on around the world is absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm.
Having the opportunity to meet with my ministerial counterparts in the UK, obviously from a different political party, but to be able to work through many of the shared issues and some of those questions that I touched upon earlier about effective administration, as well as policy issues where there may be differences of views from time to time, was incredibly important to get an understanding about what they are seeing and sharing perspectives. I think that was, for me, really important. It will inform how I go about my work. In terms of the political situation in the UK, maybe I should just say two things. In visiting the country as an Australian minister, I'm obviously not making any judgment on domestic politics in the UK.
Yeah.
But as a member of the Labor Party, to be invited to make some contributions around their policy debate was important for the same reasons I touched upon with those bilaterals with the government, to share perspectives. I'd say that when I'm asked about Australia's policy settings in either of those, I'd say we believe they work for us. Not necessarily that they are applicable. I mean, obviously, Australia's geography and other aspects are quite distinct. But I think some of the terms of the debate that we have seen play out since 2001 around questions of asylum, you know, I believe we as a party, we as a government, have taken on board some lessons that have been hard-earned to deliver a framework of policies that deliver the broad principle that the Prime Minister has set out for some time, to make sure that we can assure our communities that we are capable of and determined to maintain a secure border without abandoning our sense of humanity and compassion to those who need protection.
Mm.
And I hear the language that Keir Starmer uses, and it's different words, but really expressing the same principles around a sense of urgency about the humanitarian crisis that the world faces, and the challenge also of maintaining that sense of integrity around a migration system. And I'd say more broadly about the UK that right now the UK under its present government is a member of the Refugee Diplomacy Network, as is Australia, as we work together as resettlement countries towards the Global Refugee Forum in Geneva this year, which I think is an incredibly important moment for the world, where we have more people forcibly displaced in human history, to see again how we can not just see this as problems that individual countries confront, but a global problem that demands a global response.
Do you think there's a, well, we'll end here, do you actually think there is a prospect of some sort of global breakthrough? Because you're right, with mass movements of people after conflict or displacement or for whatever reason, it's just a can that gets kicked around the world in the absence of regional solutions, international solutions, and consistency between jurisdictions. Do you think there is a world where there could be any or all of the above?
Yes.
Do you?
Yes, I do. If I didn't, I wouldn't be doing the job that I do, Catherine. I've spent the very large part of my working life committed to these questions, and I do feel optimistic. I feel in the way in which our Foreign Minister Penny Wong has gone about rebuilding and strengthening regional relationships, we have a sound framework in our region. I'm incredibly proud of the commitments the Albanese government has made to dramatically lift our refugee intake and to explore the generosity that exists in the Australian community to go to a community sponsorship model that is very significant. And if I look around the world, the leadership of Secretary Blinken in bringing together this refugee diplomacy network, in looking towards this really important meeting in Geneva, where we recognise that there are 35 million refugees in the world right now. We face climate change driving this even more, as well as the conflicts that we started this conversation talking about. I think there is a sense of urgency in governments around the world. There certainly is a sense of urgency in my mind. I think there's also a sense of urgency in communities in this country and elsewhere. And that's why this discussion about community sponsorship, about complementary pathways, is so important, and I think can be a critical way, not just in bridging that enormous gap between the number of people who urgently need a resettlement place and the places that have been available, but in anchoring our debate around asylum and refugees in something that's stronger. We see that in Canada, where one in three Canadians are connected through community sponsorship to the experience of refugees, and where their politics has been so different to that of every other advanced economy.
Mm.
Because when you are directly connected to these experiences, it profoundly shapes your engagement with these questions. And I guess that takes me back to the social cohesion point. If we get better at listening to one another, our society gets stronger. And that's really what I'm determined to do over the next few weeks, to engage in a deep listening project, to try and bring people together, to recognise that different perspectives don't necessarily and shouldn't mean conflict here, but we can build bridges to understanding.
Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, as always, for listening. We appreciate it. Thanks for rating and reviewing and sharing and all of that jazz. Thank you, as always, to Miles Martignoni, who's the EP of this show. We will be back very soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A third of students are less than happy about their university choice, new research by EY has revealed. The findings suggest that a digital rethink is essential to meet the expectations of students and staff. Universities can address this by putting the needs of the people they serve at the heart of their digital strategies. Learn more about the future of human-centered higher education at theguardian.com/transforming higher education. This message was paid for by EY.